is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Many of the members of the Senate, other members of the body are in Portland today partaking in the commemorative breakfast at Portland at the convention center. So some of our members may be late, some of our members may be absent. That's understandable. We have today orientation. We're learning all about individual income taxes today. So those of you that are following on the internet, maybe there'll be some tips for our 1040 filings. Our income tax experts here to give us more orientation. Mr. Paul Warner, I don't have any other information for the good of the order except that Senator George informs me that the coffee will float a bolt, which means that is exactly the way the request was made to the purveyors to get good, strong coffee for the members first thing in the morning. So, okay. Mr. Warner, without more ado.
You've been duly warned.
Duly warned.
So, Mr. Chair, we're continuing our orientation, and this week we have the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, and then the property tax. We're also working on some bills that we can get before you later this week, so there'll be an opportunity to look at some specific bills. Just to remind you of the numbers we talked about last week on the personal income tax, we're extremely dependent on that as our key revenue source. 69% of total state tax revenue comes from the personal income tax. It's the highest percentage of tax revenue from any single source in the country. And 85% of the general fund comes from the personal income tax. So Ed's going to go through a series of slides with you on the mechanics of the personal income tax, the history of it, and get you to start thinking about some issues that you'll be dealing with through the session.
Good morning.
Thank you, Paul, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Paul mentioned, I'm here to try and give you a intro to personal income tax system in Oregon.
You want to do for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, for the record, Ed Waters, Legislative Revenue Office. My projector is warmed up here, so I'll try to begin.
It's always a good way to start, Mr. Chair. Turn off the lights. We have a strong coffee.
What's the coffee?
That's probably best done in the dark.
Yeah.
Senator George indicated that's why the coffee's so strong.
There are a few issues that fall under the Oregon income tax topic, most of which I'll cover today, including personal income tax. The corporate excise tax is actually tomorrow's talk. We'll put that off till then. Surplus kicker concept and system, and also the idea of fiscal stabilization funds, or as they're sometimes called, rainy day funds. I'll go briefly into that. To give you an idea of the scale and relationship between the components of the Oregon tax system, the main components of the Oregon tax system, I've prepared this slide, which I think you saw the other day as well as part of Paul's presentation. But what it shows is the rapid increase in personal income taxes in the latter part of the 90s especially. And the graph shows the personal income tax and the local property tax sort of marching along side by side up until property tax reform kicked in under Measure 5 in 1990. Property taxes leveling off and actually declining after that time, and personal income taxes taking off with the economic growth of the 1990s. As a point of reference, in 1998, which is really the last year we have full data for both personal and corporate income tax returns and collections, in 1998, there were almost 1.6 million Oregon personal income tax returns filed, reporting total AGI of $62 billion. Oregon personal income tax collections were about $3.4 billion for that year. and compare that with the property tax collections, they were about $2.5 billion. And corporate excise taxes collections were about $279 million, 1998. Reiterating the point that Paul made at the beginning about the importance of personal income taxes in the general fund, especially during the current biennium, total revenues are estimated to be about $10.2 billion, of which personal income taxes will make up about 85%, or $8.7 billion. So the general fund revenue is really dependent on personal income taxes. The starting point for calculating personal income tax is federal adjusted gross income. It's what you have at the bottom, I believe, of your federal form 1040 before you turn over to the backside and calculate your calculate your federal income tax. So Oregon uses the same starting point as the federal system to make administration and a calculation easier. But Oregon has a few items which are added into federal adjusted gross income, particularly interest on government bonds from other states. That's the main item. There are also several items which are subtracted from federal adjusted gross income, the most significant of which is our subtraction for federal income taxes paid. It currently, it's limited to $3,000, although if you'll remember in the last election, Measure 88, which was a legislative referral, was passed by the voters, and that measure will increase that limit to $5,000 beginning 2002 tax year, so next January. Next, some deductions. Normally people take either standard deductions or an itemized set of deductions. Oregon's standard deductions are different in that the joint deduction or deduction for joint filers is less than double the single deduction, so there's a bit of a marriage penalty there. Currently, the levels are $1,800 standard deduction for a single filer, $3,000 deduction for a joint filer, and those have been fixed for quite some time. They don't adjust with inflation, for example. That calculation brings us to Oregon taxable income. And to that quantity, we apply the tax rate structure, which I'll show you in just a minute, and get tax before credits, from which we subtract any tax credits, the most significant of which is the personal exemption credit, which is indexed for inflation, is currently for the 2000 tax year will be $139 per dependent. So a four-member family, for example, filing a joint personal income tax return would claim four times $139 for a total of $556 in personal exemption credits.
Mr.
Vice Chair.
Ed, what's the... How is it indexed? Is it indexed to Portland CPI?
I believe so, yeah. The personal exemption credit is indexed against the Portland CPI. The tax brackets are indexed against the U.S. CPI.
And the DOR does that adjustment annually?
That is correct.
And it's, what's it based on, what period of time?
It's annual adjustment. Is it...
For the prior year?
I believe so. Is it one of them uses the current year and one uses the fiscal year? I'd have to look that up for you to give you an exact answer. The personal income tax rate structure shown in this slide. Oregon has three-tiered personal income tax rate structure, 5%, 7%, and 9%. The 5% rate applies to taxable income up to $2,450 for the 2000 tax year. Taxable income between $2,450 and $6,100 is taxed at 7% rate, and taxable income above $6,100 is subject to the 9% rate. So the top marginal tax rate kicks in at a fairly low income level in terms of taxable income.
Ed, if I could interrupt just for a minute, I wanted to come back to the CPI and that the issue that Senator Beyer raised, and remind the committee that the issue of the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and what to use is not as straightforward as a lot of people recognize. There are a number of different measures. So there is a Consumer Price Index for Portland, which shows up in the tax code and in the case of the personal exemption credit. The Portland Index, however, comes out every 6 months. It's a relatively small sample. The index of the consumer prices that's used for the brackets is the U.S. average consumer price index, which is done on a monthly basis. Typically, they state it quite clearly, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which produces both measures, recommends that you use the U.S. CPI average. And that's why that was actually used in when the brackets were done in the 90s. The personal exemption credit was actually adjusted in the 80s, and they had Portland CPI at that time. So it was when the decisions were made was what determined what index was actually used.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator George,
this is an issue that seems to bug my wife really bad, and that is she believes, and it kind of appears to be true, that if we start taxing folks at some very, very low income levels, how do we compare with other states of where we actually apply the first tax?
Senator George, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Oregon begins taxing income, or the tax threshold, the level at which taxpayers begin paying personal income tax, is fairly low. We're one of the lowest, or we tax income at one of the lowest levels in the country.
A follow-up question.
Follow-up.
My understanding is we begin to tax even before the federal government begins to tax.
Senator George, members of the committee, that is true. Federal income taxes, although there are the tax rates are higher, they start higher and they finish considerably higher, do exempt more income before the tax rates begin to kick in. And plus they have an earned income credit, or a refundable earned income credit, which is targeted to relieve very low-income taxpayers of their tax liability, or at least some of it.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, Senator, we do have a table that shows where the states rank in terms of when you first are taxable,
mm-hmm.
and what your tax rate is for those that are just above the poverty level. So we can make that available to the committee. It shows all the states and where they rank.
I think all of us would
appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator.
In the tax rate structure, I was going to point out that the tax brackets for joint filers are exactly double the single brackets, so there's no marriage penalty in this part of the tax system anyway. By the way, going back to the previous slide, that when you hear about the marriage penalty at the federal level, that's where most of it lies, because the brackets for joint filers are not exactly double the brackets for single filers. That's where a lot of the targeted relief is.
Just a comment, if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator George, I mean, it's important that we keep in mind that it's still a low level, but you have to add in the deductions and that the likely credit. So you're really up to almost $6,000 before the first percent of Oregon taxes is attached in terms of the effective tax rate. I think you see that in the next chart there. Sometimes people look at the $2,400 and forget that you're giving the $3,056 credit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Barr.
Correct, Senator. That is a good point. The tax rates are applied to taxable income, which is after the subtractions and deductions and some other adjustments. And actual tax liability is further adjusted by the credit structure. The personal exemption credit, personal exemption in Oregon is applied as a credit after the taxes or tax before credits is calculated, as opposed to the federal system where they use a an exemption, income exemption, like a deduction.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator, yes.
Why do we do that?
Senate minutes, members of the committee, back in the 80s, I believe we had a exemption, income exemption, like federal government, and for reasons I'm not exactly clear, that was converted to an equivalent credit amount, and the credit in about 1985, and then the credit was indexed for inflation after that time.
Okay, help me if I can do it. Maybe I didn't follow you. In Oregon, we figure taxable income, then we apply the credits. Is that correct?
That is correct.
The federal, we do the credits deducted from income and then arrive at taxable income. Is that right?
Senator, Ms. Members of the committee, it's a little more involved than that, but in the exemption, the personal exemption amount that in Oregon we apply as a credit against tax liability, the analog to that in the federal system is an income exemption. So it's,
so we have a direct credit from taxes as opposed to a deduction from taxable income.
That's exactly right. It's a policy decision. We can have someone talk about the history of that decision.
But we could do it the other way, couldn't we?
That's exactly right.
We could reverse everything and make it consistent with the federal form. Just...
Senator Beyer.
Ed, am I correct, though, in terms of the differences between the deduction and the credit? The credit tends to be more progressive in terms of being more favorable towards lower-income people than the deduction would be?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, that is correct. People say that a credit, when you have a tax credit, it gives the same amount of relief in terms of your tax liability to everybody across the board. An income exemption or a deduction gives a different level of relief depending on what tax bracket that income happens to be in.
So, Mr. Chairman, again,
Senator Miss,
following up that, in essence, we are providing some additional relief for low-income people through the tax credit.
As I remember the discussion from before, really the change was after the 86 Federal Tax Act, and it was intended to keep this, to adjust the Oregon system to make it more progressive, to keep it progressive.
But which fine, do we have any graphs or charts that show the variation if we did it one way versus the other, what the effect might be?
That's, members of the committee, that's something I could run for you.
It'd be nice if we had it, just as a backdrop.
Thank you, Senator.
The next slide gets at the actual tax burden, I guess. I'm showing here average tax rate by income class for tax filers in different income classes. Along the horizontal axis, you'll see the income brackets. For example, the first one, 0 to 10, that's $0 to $10,000 taxable adjusted gross income. Next, 10 to $20,000, et cetera, up to the top cohort, which is $100,000 and above. And this graph, the height of the green bar shows the tax paid as percent of adjusted gross income for taxpayers in these different income classes. So, for example, the filers in the $0 to $10,000 class paid about 2% of adjusted gross income in Oregon income tax. The total height of these bars, including the yellow and the blue part, shows what their tax liability would be if there were no credits and if there were no surplus refund.
It really actually gets to your point.
Yeah, I think it does.
But it shows correctly how important relatively the credits, especially personal exemption credits, are to filers in the lower income ranges.
Yeah, I think that chart does actually pretty much answer the question.
So, Ed, then, I think this is important. You hear people talk about the 5 to 9% rate, and that 9's too high, and that 5's too high. But what you're showing here is effectively most people's actual tax bill is less than 5%. And no one apparently is paying over 7% in actual taxes on their income.
Senator Byron, members of the committee, that's correct. Taxes as percent of adjusted gross income. And overall, I didn't include this number on the graph, but overall, the effective tax rate on average is about 5.5%, or was at least in 1998.
Senator
Mann? This is wonderful news. Why don't we have a computation or calculation on the tax form that shows the taxpayer that they're not paying 9%? I'm dead serious. I mean, why not have a calculation that simply says that this is your tax rate after credits and so on and so forth, so that each taxpayer knows specifically what they're paying?
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, that's a good suggestion. Some people say that it's confusing enough as it is without having more tax rates floating around, but that maybe that's something that the Department of Revenue could include with the refund check.
And this, again, is before...
Hold on just a second. Let me attack that issue. If we did that, then the Department of Revenue would come back and tell us it's going to cost them more money, and we'd have to increase their budget. So the answer to that question is no, we're not going to do that. I'd rather have a calculation on the form so that the taxpayers... See, I have this thing about taxpayers should know what they're paying, which is why I do, except when my taxes get too complex and I ask for some help. But I like to do my own because I like to make sure that I understand this stuff. But I think taxpayers should understand it. We ought to have that. I just think they ought to know. There should be some calculation. If they can't figure out what is it too complex, like an algebraic equation or something?
No, it just would involve taking your tax liability, the amount online,
a little calculator,
Y, and divide it by the amount online, D or whatever.
Well, you can put a thing is, if you don't fill in this block, we're not going to send you checks.
Senator Minnis may be referring to the tax form that he's seen before, which is pencil in your gross income. This is the amount of tax.
Send it in.
But actually,
it's pretty easy. Huh?
But I think the idea of having a simple formula, as long as we're sending. Listen, if we can send the voter's pamphlet in two volumes, we can figure out how to put a line in the tax form that allows a person to calculate their own tax rate. So maybe not in this cycle, but certainly in a future cycle. Senator?
One to keep in mind, the question would be, of which number do you divide? Because remember, this is the adjusted income that we're talking about a percentage of. It's not the above the line number where you start from, and it's not even adjusted for kickers either. So it's actually a lot less. And you could make an argument. Some would make the argument anyway that particularly at the higher income level, that there is more deductibility on the federal system, so they're going to start out with a lower adjusted number than someone doing the 1040 easy.
Let's begin with something we can get our minds around. Let's try the formula on our own. Taxes. In other words, if you could provide it to the committee. If Senator Minnis can show me how to do the math, we'll...
if I can show you.
Yeah, because I know I'm not going to be able to do it.
Will everybody bring in their own last year's tax form?
So just let us have the formula, and then we'll...
We can audit each other's tax returns.
We can have a tax workshop.
But I think the point's well made that... I don't know what percentage it is of Oregonians who have helped to do their tax filings. I know I have done for many years after having operated a business, and I just kept the habit of having my taxes prepared. But the average citizen should be able to understand the tax code. The average citizen should be able to do all the calculations and filings. And if that is not the case, then we've overcomplicated the process. But in deference to Senator Minnis' observation, he has the average citizen also should be able to calculate the rate at which they're taxed. So figure out how to do it, and maybe it's something that we could include in as part of the package that taxpayers get.
Yeah. See, having mentioned the issue about increased budgets for the Department of Revenue. There's probably going to be some revenue guy that's going to show up in my office.
Actually, Senator, I was planning to refer all of them to you.
The question on the form is going to be, which deduction would you like to kick off the form?
Yeah.
Or smaller type.
Did you want to try and get control of this presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next slide shows components of adjusted gross income for this 1998 tax year we've been talking about. And the total adjusted gross income in 1998 was $62 billion for Oregon, of which 61% was wages, salaries, and tips. About 5% was dividends and interest. 8% was pensions. And one thing that sticks out is the size of the capital gains slice. 8% of adjusted gross income in 1998 was capital gains realizations. And I have another slide. Next slide compares that with 1990 at the start of the decade, when adjusted gross income was $35 billion rather than $62. Wages were a larger share of the total, two-thirds at that time, and capital gains were only about 3% of that $35 billion AGI. So it gives you an idea of the tremendous growth in certain components of income, especially capital gains over that period.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject here for a moment. Those of you who were unable to make to the Friday meeting of the House Revenue Committee, that was the emphasis that we put, is that's your biggest risk to your revenue forecast right now and your revenue outlook is that capital gains component. Because not only is it stock prices volatile, but the timing in which people make decisions as to when they're going to sell those assets, when they're going to realize those gains, is particularly tricky. So we've had capital gains quadruple over the last 8 years as a revenue source. And if you look at the December forecast for the governor's budget, almost $800 million in the 9901 biennium is revenue from capital gains. So it's a big risk right now as we look ahead the next couple of years.
Well, many of the dot-com millionaires are looking at their portfolio and the huge run-ups. I think it's sobering to see how the NASDAQ has lost value in relative terms in such a short period of time. And much of that loss of value will come home to roost in capital gains, losses in tax payments. So lots of folks are structured also. I know folks were looking at their portfolios and selling and rebuying technology stocks before the end of the year last year, posting that loss in last year's tax year. So we will see revenue projections in May. I believe that will reflect mm-hmm. what the capital gains realities will be mm-hmm. and how that will impact our revenue picture. So we can't spend the money until after May. Everybody clear on that? Senator Byers recognized.
Thank you. Ed, this is Oregon treats all income the same. There's a lot of discussion going on about capital gains. Can you talk just a little bit about distinguish between particularly business income and capital gains?
Yes, that's a good question, Senator Byers, members of the committee. Capital gains are really net gains from sale of assets. Mostly, most capital gains are related to stocks, transactions. Compared with business income, the item that's labeled business up there, that is the item people of sole proprietors in, would claim on their Schedule C, Federal Schedule C. So it's their net business income from their proprietorship after excluding expenses and setting out business related purchases. The other business item really on this sheet, or on this graph, is the miscellaneous category. Miscellaneous income includes partnership distributions, S corporation distributions, limited liability company distributions, and also grant royalty, estate, and trust income. But if you're looking at the contribution of businesses to the local economy, the business or sole proprietorship component is important. The miscellaneous income component is also very important.
That's one of the things that gets confusing for people, though, when they look at it, is if you look at it as an individual investing in something, if you invested in a IBM and you bought stock and it went up and you sold it, that would be a capital gain.
That's correct.
If you invested, you know, if some new entrepreneur came to you and said, I want you to buy into my business, and it was just structured as a partnership, that would come in as a partnership. Any growth in the business and sales would come in as a partnership distribution. Likewise, a lot of the professional companies, law firms and CPAs are now limited liability companies or limited liability partnerships. In fact, most real estate transactions, investment in real estate is now structured as limited liability partnerships. So it's going to, I mean, where it would come in as an investor, you know, it depends on which way. That's one of the things that I always thought about the nicety of Oregon's tax system is it treats income as income.
Senator Castillo.
I was wondering about the drop in the interest category. From 1990, it was 9%, and then 98, 5%. What's the reason for that?
Senator Castillo, members of the committee, that's a good question. Mostly it's interest rates. Interest rates came down dramatically from that time to the current time, or until 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we're probably declining over that whole period. So that's the reason for the difference. That's a good point. I meant to bring that up. But if you go back to 1998, interest and dividend component was 5% of AGI. In 1990, it was 9%, so almost twice as large in percentage terms.
Senator Miss?
Back to Senator Byers' question about, I think I followed business income, the 5% war, sole proprietors, whatever. The miscellaneous LLCs, S corporations that are taxed, the personal income tax rate. Where are the C corporations?
Senator Miss, members of the committee, that's a very good question as well. They don't show up in the personal income tax side other than in the interest and dividends component. So if a C corporation, if you owned stock in a C corporation and received dividends, that would show up on your personal income tax return as a on Schedule B as a dividend.
Okay, but the taxes paid by C corporations.
Taxes paid by C corporations do not show up in personal income taxes.
That's corporate tax. Okay. But, you know, you have somewhere kind of a logical progression of what all of this stuff is. I mean, I was looking at, and we're asking these questions about what are the components of capital gains, what are the components of pensions. Do we have a list of those, of these topics, what it includes? You know what I'm saying? In other words, what I'm trying to say is I'd like to have a picture of what's the total income you know, received in the state of Oregon, like the total business picture, and of that, what are the component parts and how it must flow through the tax system.
Okay.
I don't know if it makes any sense, but would help me to have something.
And actually, Senator Minnis, I'm advised that this week in subsequent orientations we'll get to the corporations, the C and S chapters and so forth. But we'll get that other.
Some of these guys that I learned visually. Mm-hmm. So if you show me, this is how much income the entire state takes in every single year, or how much business activity there's, and of this the component parts are, and keep breaking it down to the point that we get to the dollar in my wallet. That helps me kind of understand.
Senator Minnis, we will break it down until all of us are broken down, and we will get that dollar. We will get that dollar in your wallet. Absolutely.
Well, hopefully it's not a sunny day.
Right. Mr. Chairman, get there. Senator George.
As I'm looking at these pie charts, I'm thinking about Paul Harvey's famous quote of about 15 years ago, which he said, when you get all said and done, corporations aren't going to pay the taxes. Who's going to pay the taxes? Are the wage earners? I think that's very obvious here, and his comment was then wage earners ought to decide how much government, what kind of government they're willing to fund. Are you going to fund a Cadillac government or a Chevrolet government? And I think it's really clear when you look at this that that is who is paying the taxes.
Actually, I thought to Senator, Senator George, I thought you were going to remind us that Paul Harvey said when it was all said and done, or was said when was ever done.
Been done.
Mr. Chair, in response to Senator Nissen's question, I think the orientation, I hope the orientation tomorrow on the corporate tax side will answer some of your questions and help to satisfy some of your curiosity about those issues. At least get you started there, and hopefully before we get too close to any of that. The next slide, we're back to the 1998 tax year now. I've tried to arrange it on your handout so it shows 1998 and 1990 tax years sort of side by side so we can compare different components. But again, for 1998 tax year, total number of returns was of almost 1.6 million. And this graph shows the distribution of tax returns, so the number of tax returns submitted, filed with the Department of Revenue by the same income classes as I showed you previously.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George is right
here. I hate to keep going back to the same subject, but, you know, if you look at this, the 0 to 10,000 income folks overwhelmingly are the ones filling out these reports. And have we ever calculated what the average cost is to them? Because that's a much greater impact for them to go through the process. Most of them are probably going to go hire somebody to do it anyway. And yet, you know, their income is so low. Have we ever calculated what the impact is, the social implications of the fact that we're forcing them to fill out returns with a very low income?
Senator Jones, members of the committee, I haven't looked at that. It's important to keep in mind that a lot of the filers in that category are dependents, so high school kids who are working part-time had some taxes withheld and want to get that money back, so they file an income tax return. Also, you find people in that category who have income from various sources, including some large negative components, large business losses or whatever. So they probably invest a lot in accounting services anyway to calculate their business loss. At least I would look at that very carefully if I were them.
For everyone here, that means that they're farmers.
Senator George, members of the committee, that's a good point. A lot of generally, every year, if you look at the net farm income claimed on Oregon tax returns, the total is invariably negative. Comparing that picture with 1990, you'll see that there were fewer returns filed in 1990, 1.3 million, compared with almost 1.6 million in 1998. But also the thing to notice here is, in 1998, how many more returns there were in the higher income categories, that is from the 40,000 to 60,000 category on up. If you allow me to just flip back and forth a little bit here. Here's 1998 again. 1990. So we had considerable growth in numbers of filers in the higher income categories over those 8 years.
Ed, can we go back to the 1998 distribution of tax returns? Senator George, your question, I think, triggered another piece of information that has to correlate with the distribution of tax returns. The first column, 0 to 10,000, you see more than 360,000 individual tax filers. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got about 80,000, 90,000 possibly filers. The slide that we need to correlate to this is what is the source of income or what is the source of a revenue for the state when distributed against this chart?
From those categories,
right. And at the high end, I understand, I'll just defer to a staff to explain at the high end how much revenue produced.
Probably it's just the opposite of this.
It may.
Mr. Chair, we have your next slide showing adjusted gross income by these groups. Well, it takes you halfway there, but We don't have a slide showing revenue. We can get that for you. I think the number that stands out most is that 100,000 group there, filers for those 98 returns, that was 40% of income tax revenue came from that group.
That is one?
From the 100-plus group.
Mr. Chair, members, may I advance to the next slide? And this shows average adjusted gross income in each of those same categories. We're back to the 1998 tax year. The overall average in 1998 was about $39,112. And the bars show how that was distributed. The thing to note here is in the higher income category, from the previous slides, we saw the growth in numbers of filers in that category. But on average, filers in that $100,000 plus category had about $222,000 adjusted gross income in 1998. Paul mentioned they were the heart and soul, the meat and potatoes of the taxpayers.
Ed, most of us don't think in terms of AGI. We think in terms of revenue, you know, what the paycheck says. Would that correlate to about the 39, about 50,000 in income, average income?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, it varies, of course, depending on
family size
and what people claim. And AGI includes, it's a net income measure, so it includes losses and that have been netted out of positive income. I can take a look.
I don't want you to do any work. I'm just curious what you think it is.
Generally, the gap increases with higher income. So for low income, if you think of the a joint filer with two kids in the $20,000 income range, their total income and their adjusted gross income would probably be pretty close. But a filer in the higher income category who had more kinds of business activities going on, there would be more of a divergence. I can probably find something for you that will give you a better idea what that gap is.
Atticus, yeah.
And if I'm reading these charts correctly, it looks like you don't see a whole lot of increase or any increase on adjusted gross income for most of the categories until you get up into the higher categories. Is that correct? So for people on the low end of the income scale, they didn't really see much difference.
Well, Senator Castillo, members of the committee, that's a good point. But really, it's built into the structure because what we have here are income brackets. So the average cannot be outside of that income bracket. What has happened is you've had people moving up the income ladder or more higher income people coming in at higher levels. But the average income in each category doesn't really tell you very much, except for the point that you made at the higher end. There is now, or in 1998, the average income was about $25,000 higher in 1998 than it was in 1990. Plus, there are a lot more filers in that category.
Mm-hmm. I think also we do need those revenues categories, or at least categorized and spread into brackets, compared with the adjusted gross incomes and the number and type of tax filers. And that will help us put it in perspective. We've heard that the taxes in Oregon are perhaps more progressive than other places. I think members need to see that displayed.
You need to keep in mind, too, when you're looking at the difference between 1990 and 98, that you had that this is not inflation adjusted on the income side. And you've got about an average 2% inflation in every year for 8 years in there. So there would be, I'm not sure how much the impression is that we've had developing growth in income, but not necessarily interest in power.
Senator, that's a good point. These are not inflation-adjusted numbers. This is the 1990 picture I showed you, where we were discussing. Overall average adjusted gross income in 1990 was $26,610, compared with that 1998 average, which was $39,112. Again, not inflation adjusted. I think the next two slides are some of the most interesting, and I think help to get at some of the issues and questions that committee has from some of the prior slides. But what I've tried to show here are the distribution of the components of adjusted gross income by the different income classes. And, for example, the top blue bar there shows that other income component, the bar below that, the miscellaneous component, that is the partnership, S corporation, limited liability corporation, company, distribution component, pensions, red part is capital gains, yellow is business, green dividends and interest, and then the white part, the base of that is the wage and salary component. But what this and the following graph for the 1990 tax year show are the predominance of wages and salaries as a source of income, taxable income, for filers in almost all the categories. But when you get to the $100,000 level, wages and salaries are actually less important, or less than half, I guess, of total adjusted gross income. And some of the other adjusted gross income components become very important and much more prominent, especially the miscellaneous income component and the capital gains component. And again, this graph shows total adjusted gross income in each of these income categories. So of the total AGI of $62 billion, almost $20 billion was in the $100,000 plus income category.
Mr. Chair, if I could add something here, too, and back to our earlier discussion in terms of capital gains and the volatility there. When we think of a downturn in the economy, we normally think of unemployment and people losing their jobs, but that, of course, is the major cost of a recession or a downturn. But in terms of the revenue stream, where you really see it first is in that upper group, mm-hmm. because those business components of income are very volatile. So, you know, proprietor income, for example, may actually fall from the prior year. And many times you'll see the highest income payers, those 500 and above, their incomes will actually be less than they were the prior year. And so, and that's, of course, a significant part of the revenue base. And that's where you'll see the most volatility on your actual revenue collection.
I can also see that we clearly need more $50,000 a year jobs. We've got a pretty steady progression from $10,000 to $40,000. And then there seems to be quite a hop between the category at 40 and then the category at 60. Mm-hmm. And just perhaps it's an anomaly of the graph, but that mid-category of jobs in the career ladder creates a lot of revenue for the state of Oregon. And I just wonder if that's the difference between blue-collar and high-tech white-collar in occupations. There isn't a gap there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, I think that's part of it. Also, keep in mind that these are filers, so there are different numbers of earners. Mm-hmm. And distribution of that would show, I think, have a spike in this area where you have a lot of two-person joint filers,
sure.
two working people filing joint return.
I thought, Mr. Chair, that you were going to go back to your standard statements and say the first four bars up there represent rural Oregon and the last three are Washington County.
Well, I don't have to, since you just did that. I keep being so sensitive to those issues.
You were listening.
First step.
Getting at the progressivity issue that we've been talking about a little bit, in this 1998 tax year, of the total adjusted gross income, about 31% of it falls in this $100,000 income category. And, and they paid about 39% of personal income taxes in 1998. In 1990, we've got a much more pronounced mode, I guess. We have this middle bar, $40,000 to $60,000. Middle-income families were much more important piece of the total taxable income structure, and we had fewer filers, and therefore a much lower total adjusted gross income at these higher income levels. The relationship between wages and total adjusted gross income is pretty similar to 1998 in that wages and salaries are generally the most important component up to the, you get to the $100,000 plus, where the other income components become relatively more important and more diversified. I just mentioned that in 1998, that the $100,000 and up filers had 31% of AGI and paid about 39% of taxes. In 1990, this group had about 15% of total AGI and paid about 21% of taxes, personal income tax. And the most important group was this $40,000 to $60,000 cohort. They had 22% of AGI and paid about 24% of total Oregon income tax.
Do you have a chart that addresses the number of filers by those brackets? Is that the previous one?
Yes, Senator Beyer, that, let's see, graph number, Graphs 11 and 12, I think, from a couple of pages prior to that, show the numbers of returns in each category. Mm-hmm. And it does show a significant growth, for example, in that, in the top three income categories, really. Okay, on to the next item, which next component of the Oregon income tax structure, which is tax credits. This graph shows the total for 1998 total Oregon income tax credits claimed and the distribution of those credits and that what credits were they, how much of each. The overwhelmingly dominant one is the personal exemption credit. As I mentioned before, that's every filer or every dependent gets that, and a filer with multiple dependents claims multiple credits. So it's the largest share. Other credits that Oregon income taxpayers claimed in 1998 include the credit for taxes paid to other states. That's a mechanism to help prevent double taxation between Oregon and other states who might tax or try to tax the same income. A retirement income credit, dependent care credit, credit for political contributions, and also the two credits which this committee really started in the 1997 session, the working family child care credit and the earned income credit. I'll give you a little more detail on those two in a minute. By the way, other credits here is quite a long list of things, but it includes some of the what we normally think of as the corporate credits or business credits, which are claimed by non-corporate filers. It also includes the rural medical practice credit, which is a credit to encourage physicians to remain and practice in rural areas, and some other things as well. In terms of, again, here I'm showing the total tax relief, I guess, after you calculate tax before credits, then you subtract credits. In 1998, we also had a sizable, or actually 1999, we had a sizable surplus refund that went back to taxpayers, but it was calculated based on the 1998 personal income tax year. The surplus refunds mailed out in 1999 were $164 million, and that offset some of the tax liability personal income tax filers in that 1998 tax year.
What was the rate? The refund rate?
The refund rate was 4.6% of net liability for that kicker. The working family tax credit group, as I mentioned, in 1997, the legislature passed Senate Bill 388, which established working family tax credits, of which there are two components. The earned income credit, which is calculated based on the federal earned income credit, and the working family child care credit, which is calculated as a share or a percentage of qualified child care expenses actually incurred by the taxpayer. These were targeted to low-income taxpayers, and as they, in the final version, they were both non-refundable credits, which means that the amount of credit claimed by any taxpayer cannot exceed the tax liability. For example, if someone did the worksheet and calculated that they were eligible for a $100 working family child care credit, but their tax liability was only $80, they would only be able to claim $80. They wouldn't be able to claim the full $100. Last session, 1999 session, Senate President's bill, Senate Bill 2, actually expanded the income limits, expanded eligibility for the working family child care credit. And these income limits are expressed in terms of federal poverty level. Utilization of the working family tax credits. We have 2 years of utilization data available, 1997 tax year and 1998 tax year. Number of claims for the earned income credit was almost 154,000 in 1997. That went up to almost 156,000 in 1998. Total amount of credit claimed also increased from 9.6 million in 1997 to about 10 million in 1998. The working family child care credit, there were about 15,000 claimants in 1997. That increased to over 16,000 in 1998. And the amount of total credit claimed also increased from about $5.2 million in 1997 to $6 million in 1998. Changing gears here again, Oregon also has the nexus legal right and ability to tax income earned by residents and also income earned from Oregon sources by non-residents. And this applies to not only full-year residents, but also part-year residents who may have lived in Oregon during the tax year but moved out, moved to another state, or lived somewhere else and moved to Oregon during the tax year. It also applies to non-residents. The most common example of that, I guess, are commuters from, for example, Clark County, Washington, who come across to work in Portland or metro area. And also another example would be an absentee landlord, someone who lived in, say, Washington, but owned property in Oregon that generated income for them. Another issue in the Oregon tax system, which we may have a chance to become familiar with again this session, is the checkoff donations program. What these are, there's a taxpayers can elect to donate a part of their refund, if they are receiving a refund, to any of five funds which are listed at the bottom of the personal income tax form. Total donations or total checkoffs in 1998 tax year were about $606,000. So people elected to forego part of their income tax refund and instead donate it to these eligible charities.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator George is recognized.
What was the total amount of the refund?
Senator George, members of the committee, the total amount of donations, total amount of refunds?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to look that up, okay. Senator George.
Okay.
I don't know that exactly. But 606,000 of that was donated to these checkoffs.
Yes, okay.
Do these checkoffs, I think they rotate, or what is the mechanism for getting a checkoff item on the...
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question and a long story. There are currently five charities on the tax form, although I guess I should, that's not exactly correct. Beginning with the 2000 tax year, forms for which are going out now, there are still those five charities you see on this slide, but there's been added an extra line just below that. It's a blank line. And taxpayers are instructed to, if they wish to donate to another charity that's listed on a page, a table in the Oregon income tax instructions, they can take that, the name or the code for that charity, write it in on that line, and indicate how much they wish to donate. And eligibility to be on that list is regulated. There's a commission, Oregon Charitable Checkoffs Commission, which reviews applications for charities who wish to be listed on that income tax instruction form. And there are certain conditions they have to fulfill in order to be eligible. But we've been, it's a interesting issue. We've worked, this committee has spent quite a bit of time of it in the last two sessions. And the decision to have an extra line included on the tax form came at the end of a fairly long and interesting process, I guess I should say.
I withdraw the question.
Okay, shifting gears quite a bit here, I have a couple of slides to try and give you an entree into the revenue forecast and the surplus kicker issue, and there is a connection there, believe it or not. The revenue estimating process is conducted by, not by our office, but by the executive branch, by the state economist, who resides in the Office of Economic Analysis over in DAS. And they produce quarterly forecasts of the economy, Oregon personal income taxes, Oregon corporate excise taxes, and some other tax items that go into the general fund as well, other revenue items that go into the general fund as well. But the starting point is a model and a contract currently held by a firm called Data Resources Incorporated. They generate a U.S. forecast or a range of U.S. forecasts, which are fed into the Oregon economic model by the state economist to produce a final economic forecast. This is reviewed by a couple of advisory groups, including the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, and then also a group of economists from state government agencies and also some other local government economists as well. This final economic forecast, once it has been agreed on and approved by the Governor's Council, is fed into the corporate tax model to generate the corporate tax revenue estimate. Also, variables from the forecast are fed into the personal income tax model to produce the personal income tax revenue estimate. And again, like I said, this is done quarterly, so it's really an ongoing process, but the results, the forecast documents, are published quarterly. Now, why is this important to us? Well, number one, it tells us how much general fund revenue is available, changes that may be occurring to that, and eventually gives us a good idea of how much we should have available to budget, and it's actually the amount used to calibrate the final budget. And another reason why it's important is that the close of session forecast, which is used to calibrate the budget, also calibrates the threshold for the 2% kicker. Now, what is the 2% kicker? Well, it's a system that's set up. It originated in a statute in, I believe, 1979. It was recently added to the Constitution, Measure 86, which was a referral from the legislature and passed in the 2000 general election. But the way the process works is that it's at the end of the end of a biennium. If corporate income tax revenues exceed the close of session estimate of what those revenues were estimated to be by 2% or more, then that entire excess amount from zero up to whatever is credited to corporate taxpayers. So that's one component of the kicker. There's a look at the corporate revenues received, compare those with the original forecast of those revenues. If the excess is more than 2% higher than originally forecast, a corporate credit results. And the other piece of it is you also look at everything other than corporate revenues. You look at other general fund revenues. The most important component, of course, is personal income tax revenue. If those revenues exceed the close of session estimate by 2% or more, then that entire excess is refunded to personal income taxpayers in the form of a check that is mailed out. By law, it has to be mailed before December 1st of the year in which the biennium ends. The corporate credit is claimed on the in odd-numbered years if there is a kicker. So, if, for example, if there were to be a kicker in the current 1999-01 biennium, then corporate taxpayers would claim that credit based on their 2001 tax liability. So the taxes they'll file next year. If there are personal income tax refunds to be made, personal income tax kicker, then those refunds would be calibrated based on 2000 tax year liability. So the tax forms that people will be filling out in this period between now and April 15th. So it's fairly complicated. There are the two funds, really, the two pots, corporate and other, and then there are different mechanisms for handling how a surplus is returned to taxpayers, depending on which fund it's in. A history of surplus kicker refunds. This table shows we've had or potentially had a refund, a surplus in every biennium, really, since 1983-85. In 1991, the legislature actually voted to suspend personal income tax refunds. And you'll note that in that year, there was actually a deficit in the corporate income tax revenues. And again, in the following biennium, 1991-93, the 93 legislature voted to suspend the corporate kicker credit. And at that time, although there was a $60 million surplus in the personal income tax pot, it was not sufficient to, it was less than 2% of the forecast, so it wouldn't have generated a refund. One thing to notice here is that the 97-99 biennium, the last biennium, we did have a personal income tax surplus. It was a refunded as 5% of taxpayers' 1998 tax liability. Or it was actually 4.6%. These are rounded up. So it was about 4.6% of their 1998 tax liability. And there was actually a shortfall in the corporate income tax projection for that biennium. So even though a personal income tax kicker refund was going out, there was a shortfall in corporate tax revenues.
Senator Castillo's recognition.
So when we look at the percentage columns, then the percentages mean that that was the percentage of reduction in the personal income tax for that year. Is that the correct way to look at that?
Senator Castillo, members of the committee, that's exactly right. That's a good question. For example, that 97-99 figure in red, the 5%, represents the percent of 1998 tax liability that was refunded. So it's like a reduction in their 1998 tax year liability.
So in 1993-95, under the corporate, there would have been a 50% reduction in the corporate income tax for 93-95.
That the way that is expressed is that $167 million was credited, and that was credited as a 50% reduction in their 1995 tax liability.
Oh, okay, I see.
1995 tax year liability.
Senator Castillo, another way to look at the, it's rough approximation, but the amount of revenue above the forecast is about half that percent.
Right.
So, for example, in 99-01, the 7%, it was about 3.5% over forecast. It's for a two-year period versus a one-year credit.
Okay.
That's correct. The numbers in red do not show the overage or the percent of general fund. It shows the percent of tax liability that was refunded or credited for the designated tax year.
Senator Beyer?
So I'm assuming the 99-01, is it based on the current projection, the economic projection? What is the, and that's, all of it goes back, so what's the threshold for the personal? The 2%, that's 1.9% or whatever. How much over are we projected to be over the kicker limit? Am I asking that?
You know that? Senator Byer, I think the 2%, what you would do is calculate the May 15 forecast plus legislative changes, and you just take general fund minus corporate,
yeah,
that becomes your base. And 2% of that is about 182 million.
182.
So that means you've got about 109 million. So if the forecast were to drop by 115 million on the non-corporate piece, then there'd be no kicker. I mean, I shouldn't say the forecast were to drop, but if actuals were to come in 115 less than the December forecast, there'd be no kicker.
And that's a good point that Senator Beyer brought up. That number for 1999-01 is estimate based on the December 2000 revenue forecast, which is the most current we have.
The other thing I might add to this discussion, Mr. Chair, is that and I recall in 91-93, there, you notice there's an $18 million corporate credit there, which was suspended, but that was actually above 2%. That was not actually forecast in the May 15 forecast. And it occurred, and I remember vividly, the last week of the biennium, which was late June, Department of Revenue received an $8 million payment from the corporation.
and that's what pushed it over the 2% kicker threshold. And I remember coming before this committee and explaining that, well, we didn't think there was a kicker, but now there is. And so, it, remember, it's the forecast is never the key component. The forecast sets the base, but it's the actual compared to that base. So you never really know what that kicker is until all the numbers come in. And in terms of the personal income tax, the way we do the accounting on withholding, you don't know that till August.
Mr. Warner, do you remember hearing the conspiracy theories about the corporate kicker kicking that year?
Mm-hmm.
Or should I just share that with the
committee? Oh, I've heard lots of conspiracy theories. Well, I mean, you do have, and Ed will show you in terms of when we look at the corporate income tax tomorrow, there are a relatively small number of corporations that have a large impact on our revenue stream.
Right.
I certainly have the capability of pushing the forecast above or below the 2%. The experience I've had, and Department of Revenue may comment on this too, is that most of the large national, international corporations don't consider the Oregon tax liability to be a key factor. I mean, it's a relatively small amount of their total. So one of the problems we've had in the past in forecasting is that many corporations are unaware of the kicker. They will actually overpay and then get a refund, and the Department of Revenue will get questions, you know, what is this kicker? What is this? And so then they end up with a large refund. So it isn't something that's really driven decisions, at least that's the indication that corporations are basing their decisions on other factors beyond Oregon's borders on their tax payments.
Notwithstanding that explanation, there was speculation that one corporation decided that they would do better financially by making prepayments and taxes and causing the kicker to kick.
It certainly could happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you know, somebody looks at this chart and they say, well, I see here that corporations got a 50% reduction in 93-95 and a 42%, you know, and then they look at the personal side and say the highest that any, there's a personal discount was 17%. What would account for that is based on the estimates of the two different categories about when the kicker kicks.
Yeah, basically. Okay. Senator, there are two things that come into play there. One is simply the fact that corporate revenue is based on corporate profits, and corporate profits are notoriously volatile.
Mm-hmm.
They can be negative as you know, many corporations aren't going to have a negative profit for a year. I mean, big corporations, whereas you're not going to see that on the personal income side. The other element is it's just a smaller number.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get, if you have 2% of that number for the 99-01 period is roughly it's less than $15 million, and we have a number of corporations who pay more than that themselves. So it's going to be a bigger percentage when you see a difference with a 4K.
I think there's so many misconceptions about the kicker. The kicker refund does not allow a corporation not to pay every dollar of taxes that it's owed. The corporate kicker, even if unclaimed, would always be a credit against future income taxes. So, you know, there's been various theories floated about keeping it, using it. People overlook the fact that the corporate kicker is money that the taxpayer does not owe, and money that must be credited against future liabilities. One of the brightest things that we've seen happen in the initiative process is that you now no longer have to spend 30 to 45 days arguing about the corporate kickers. We're all sworn to uphold the Constitution here, and it is now a matter of constitutional law. But I think that'll maybe lower the rhetoric about what is the kicker and how does it kick and whose money is it really. I hope that's true. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last item I had to run you through, run by you, I guess, was the idea of fiscal stabilization funds or rainy day funds, and what some of the issues are concerning that. Currently, at least 45 states have some kind of a stabilization fund in their revenue and budget structure. Oregon is one of the few states that does not. There are at least four states that have more than one fund for designated purposes or multiple designated purposes. Those are listed there. Most of these funds are statutory, although at least seven states have a constitutional, at least one constitutional fund as well. So there's quite a bit of information available about the structures of these different kinds of funds in different states if you're interested in that. What kind of issues are there to consider in setting up some kind of a fiscal stabilization fund? First is a legal authorization. Is it going to be a statutory fund or is it going to be a constitutional established fund? Methods for deposits into the fund, would it be by appropriation? would there be some cutoff, period end surplus would automatically go into the fund? Or is it by some formula? For example, if there's a growth in personal income above a certain level, then a certain amount of money would go into the fund. Methods for withdrawing money from the fund. It might be required to only cover a deficit or a shortfall in certain circumstances, or certain non-recurring expenditures, or only in emergencies which are triggered by specific conditions. Or it might be by appropriation, and you could have that appropriation require a supermajority in order to pass. Also, issues regarding the fund size. Is there going to be a cap on the maximum amount of dollars that can accrue into that fund? Is that going to be a fixed dollar amount or some percentage of a general fund, for example? And what happens when that cap is exceeded? Is there going to be some kind of a surplus refund mechanism, like our current kicker mechanism, for example? These issues, I think, are a little more complex now. They're not totally academic, but they're more complex now that we do have Measure 86 and we have a kicker in the Constitution. But it is something that you'll probably hear about and you may want to think about during this session. One example of a fund, this is from the 1997 session. It started out quite a bit simpler than this, but of course these things get more complicated. What it would have done was it would have taken revenues above the forecast amount, and those would be committed to this reserve fund, at least to begin with. Also, any lottery revenues above a certain threshold that came in this case it was set at $600 million, those would be committed to this reserve fund. Withdrawals from the reserve fund could occur in cases of economic recession, and the bill had definite criteria that you would have to look at and satisfy for there to be an economic recession situation. And if those conditions held, then there could be an appropriation from the fund to public education. If the fund balance got above, accrued over time and got above 7% of general fund, then there would be a mechanism for distributing that surplus. Some of the money would be refunded to taxpayers. Certain components of it might be deposited in the education endowment fund. There are a number of different mechanisms and scenarios that were discussed in connection with this particular concept.
What we have left here is a something that also appears on page 37 of the NFL playbook. The House Bill 2007 did get a lot of discussion in the building, but one of the things, and notwithstanding Senator Byers' admonition about rural versus urban, all of the schools in rural Oregon could close before a single dollar ever came out of the educational reserve fund if we looked at the way this at least the way it was proposed originally. So it would have to be raining in Portland before it rained anywhere else in the state. If we could go back one slide. In my mind, these stabilization funds are in people's minds, I think, related to self-service gas stations, sales tax, and stabilization fund. But, you know, it doesn't matter that 47 other states have these things, even if we call Washington, D.C. a state. But we do have on the table an opportunity for something like a stabilization fund that would cause this body to have to do some soul searching and show some political will, and that's the tobacco dollars. If we decided to put the tobacco dollars, actually the whole principal amount, in a reserve fund and use only the interest off that for healthcare enhancements, that would function essentially as about a $350 million stabilization fund. But the budgets that we've had presented so far by the governor use all but $100 million of those dollars.
We had a couple of those on the ballot this last time, Mr. Chair. I think that was sponsored by the initiatives. The voters were pretty loud on how they felt about those.
Said no.
Let's see. That would be 5 and 89, I believe.
That would be 4 and 89.
4 and 89, right. Well, I worked on the 89.
We both tried. We both lost.
But my belief is not that the folks decided that spending all that tobacco money on various and sundry wish lists of either legislators or the governor is not what they voted for. So, you know, we might think they didn't vote for 4 and they didn't vote for 89, but I don't think they voted for the proposal that we've got before us either. So, and then the slide before this one, he talked about the certain conditions that might kick in, or I guess that was a subsequent slide. Yeah, that was the methods for withdrawals, and that would be emergencies, and those would be defined by particular legislators as their projects in their districts. So the problem has always been what makes the fund withdraw. That's always been an issue that's stumbled or tripped everyone trying to put together stabilization funds. It's not that the money goes in, and in prior sessions when we've had relatively large general fund dollars, it's what makes the money come out in the problem. I guess that brings us to the end of our presentations for this morning, unless there's something additional.
That's all I had, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Warner, do you have anything else to add?
Mr. Chair, we have corporate income taxes for you tomorrow, and as I said earlier, we're working on getting some bills for you to look at this week.
Okay. So there's your preview of coming attractions. We'll be back tomorrow morning at the same time, 8:30 in the morning, same place, in the hearing room A.
And there will be coffee.
There will be coffee. Unless there are any other items of business that come before this committee, we stand in adjournment until tomorrow at 8:30.